I've always dreamed of being able to order my coffee in Italian like a local, instead of just pointing at the menu and hoping for the best. There's something about speaking another language with real confidence that opens up a whole new world of experiences. That's why I'm so excited about Rosetta Stone Sapphire. It's their biggest launch in over a decade. It takes that research-backed method we all know and trust and adds fresh, cutting-edge features that make it easier than ever to go from knowing a few phrases to speaking naturally about the topics you actually care about. What I love is that you aren't just memorizing vocabulary lists. You learn entirely in your new language through visuals and audio, just like you did as a kid. One of my favorite new features is chat missions. It turns conversation practice into a game, putting you in real-world scenarios, like ordering at a restaurant or asking for directions, and giving you missions to complete. You get real-time feedback along the way, so you build that confidence before you ever have to use your skills in the real world. If you want to take your language skills to the next level, don't wait to try Rosetta Stone Sapphire. Listeners of this podcast can get 20% off their Rosetta Stone Sapphire subscription when they sign up today. This gets you access to Rosetta Stone Sapphire in 25 languages. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10 to redeem your 20% off. That's rosettastone.com/rs10.
A lot has changed since Bob's Discount Furniture opened its first store 35 years ago. Car phones have become cell phones, grunge band hits have become oldies, and you can order furniture online. But what hasn't changed is the way they do business, aka the Bob's way. Doing things the Bob's way means that when I shop at Bob's, I know I'll find the latest top-rated styles like the Aspen sofa for just $399, bedrooms with storage and charging, Consumer Reports recommended mattresses, real marble dining sets, and more, all at 90s-era prices. There's even no money down financing and lightning fast shipping, so you aren't stuck waiting months for your furniture to arrive. Plus, Bob's still makes furniture shopping fun with friendly associates and cafes full of free treats and ice cream. Want to see for yourself? Stop into your local Bob's store this Labor Day weekend to party it up like it's 1991 and celebrate 35 years of doing things the Bob's way.
Welcome to The Takeout. I'm Ed O'Keefe in for Major Garrett. We are at the CBS Broadcast Center in New York. There is no bar here, I assure you. Today, though, was day four of deliberations in the Lindsey Clancy murder trial. This morning, the jury informed the judge they were unable to come to a unanimous verdict. Any trial where a jury has to decide someone's fate is no doubt a difficult process, but in this case, the jury has an especially agonizing task, deciding the punishment for a mother who's admitted to killing her three young children. The judge instructed the jury to keep trying to come to a conclusion. Whether they will be able to remains to be seen. We start this evening with CBS News correspondent Chanel Call, who joins us once again from her position outside the courthouse in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Chanel, great to see you. What is the latest on jury deliberations at this hour?
Hey, Ed, good to see you, too. So here's what happened at about 3:30 this afternoon Eastern time. Those jurors put in a formal request asking the judge to go home early. This is the same thing that happened yesterday, although I'll note yesterday when that happened, the jurors seemed to look more stressed. Some of them looked a bit sad, a bit frustrated. That wasn't really the scene today. But you remember what happened this morning. Just about 45 minutes after beginning deliberations this morning is when we got a note that they had a question. The judge then relaying that note in open court, saying the jury is now saying that they have not reached a verdict, that they're having a hard time getting there. Essentially, they're at an impasse. They are deadlocked. So a very pivotal day in this trial. There's a couple of different ways this could go from here, Ed. I mean, the next steps here is that they'll resume deliberations tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. After that, at any point, they can come forward and say, look, we have been able to reach a verdict. If that doesn't happen, they could come back and tell the judge, we're still at this impasse. We've tried again, and we are still deadlocked. If that's what ends up happening here, Ed, likely we'll hear the judge read out loud this thing that's called a charge, essentially that is a final and formal ask of, it's called a diamond charge, came to me finally. But essentially it's a final and formal ask of the jury to continue to try to deliberate again. And if that happens and the jury comes back and says we've tried this second time around, it still hasn't worked, that's when it would trigger a potential mistrial.
All right. Chanel, call there for us in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Thank you for continuing to monitor things for us. And we'll, of course, talk to you tomorrow whenever they get back, however they continue deliberating. CBS News legal contributor and federal criminal defense attorney Caroline Polizzi joins me now for analysis, picking up on where Chanel left off on the idea that they can go back in there and try again. Is there a way for a judge to gauge whether he thinks the jury has indeed really tried again? Like, do you give them a certain amount of hours, or do you, like, put your ear to the door and hear enough screaming in there to go, okay, they tried?
Right. No, it's really a difficult position that the judge is in. This first time, as Chanel alluded to, it was a more casual instruction to the juror saying, look, we've spent 5 weeks here at this trial. You've heard over 80 witnesses. You guys are a good, conscientious, diligent jury. You can come to a verdict. Give it another, the old college try.
Right.
This next time, if they do come back, which Chanel was talking about, he will administer a more formal admonition, which is called the Tui Rodriguez charge. And Chanel called it the dynamite charge. We call that colloquially because it's meant to ignite a fire under the jury. It's difficult, though, Ed, because, look, the whole point of jury deliberations is you want to keep an open mind, you want to think about the evidence, but you want to hew to your own beliefs and integrity. So if you have someone in there that's a real holdout that just is never, ever going to come to the other side, I mean, that's when you get a deadlocked jury. That's when you could get a mistrial, which would be sort of a devastating outcome for everybody in this case.
Sure. And then what options would the prosecution have at that point if it goes to a mistrial?
Yeah, so then the prosecution has a real decision to make whether or not they want to move forward with charging this case again and going through a trial. You remember at the beginning of this trial, the defense attorney, Kevin Reddington, actually proposed a bifurcation wherein he and his client would admit to actual guilt and there would just be a trial on the not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect. So therefore, it would just be about her mental state. They could do that. They might try to come to some sort of a plea deal. But I think, look, the state really wants to pursue these charges. I think it's likely that they would come back a second time, try again.
And she's charged with 3 counts of first degree murder. But as you alluded to, she could be convicted on lesser charges.
Yeah.
That's got to make the jury conversation a little more confusing and complicated, right?
Absolutely.
Because they can sit there and go, well, this, no, but maybe that. And
yeah.
Others are going to disagree, and then they got to figure out how to get through that. Right?
Yeah, those are called lesser included charges. They kind of go down the line. So first degree, top charge, second degree as well. And then at the last minute, the judge added, at the defense's request, a manslaughter charge, which that's kind of threw everybody for a loop because the facts don't really line up with a manslaughter charge, but it is sort of a very tempting compromise verdict. It's known sort of in the industry because if juries want to reach a verdict, but they can't really decide one way or the other, sometimes it's a really tempting option because
it's
just
they know the floor almost.
Yeah, because they know it's a less severe sentence.
Yeah. What's your gut tell you? Tomorrow's the day?
This looks like a hung jury. I mean,
really?
It does to me, but we'll see. I'm hopeful that they can get there, but the more time that goes on, the more it looks like a hung jury.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah.
Caroline Polizzi, thanks for being here.
In
other news today, the U.S. conducted more strikes against Iran after 2 tankers were targeted in the Strait of Hormuz. President Trump took to social media to threaten the regime that they will be hit much harder if they retaliate. CBS News senior White House correspondent Weijia Zhang has more from the White House. Weijia, good to see you. What is the White House saying about these latest strikes?
Great to see you, Ed. Well, President Trump himself went on social media and he warned that if Iran retaliated for this latest round of U.S. strikes, that there would be an even harder hit coming to them. And he said he was going to save the biggest hit for another time. You can see there, he said the failed nation of Iran retaliates for this very justified attack. They will be hit again at a much harder and higher level. But Iran also responded, Ed, and said that America would regret its latest attack. So clearly, we are in a situation where there's a tit for tat, an escalation in this aggression after over a month with no strikes. And Ed, just yesterday, I asked President Trump if this was going to be part of a return to a full-scale war or if it's just part of a limited campaign. He said it would be very limited, but again, warned that more could come. And here we are again. So we're waiting now to see whether Tehran launches any strikes in response to this latest round.
And if they do, they often do in the next few hours. So we'll wait and see. Mm-hmm. Look, with voters so concerned about the cost of things and inflation, the president today met with oil executives at the White House. Did we get any sense of progress on lowering gas prices?
You know, we actually just pinged the White House again to get some sort of a summary, a readout of that meeting, and we haven't gotten details. So I'm hoping that your next guest, Tommy Pigott, is going to break some news for us to share what was talked about and what the reality is, Ed, because obviously we know that a huge topic, perhaps at the top of the agenda, is how to refine oil domestically at a much larger scale.
All right, we lost Ouija there for a moment, but to her point, the intrigue about how exactly to drive down oil prices is not only a domestic concern, it is a global concern as well. And for that, we bring in our next guest, State Department spokesman Tommy Pigott. Tommy, great to see you there from the State Department, Foggy Bottom, as we call it there in D.C. Let's start on Iran, however, because the U.S. Ramping up these strikes again. The conflict still centers around the Strait of Hormuz, which President Trump said yesterday he said in general that it is safe. How are these latest strikes different than what we've seen previously?
Well, look, the president being very clear for a long time now that there'd be a zero tolerance policy when it comes to efforts to mine the Strait of Hormuz. That was something that he truthed out when he announced that it was mine-free based off of efforts from the United States and others in terms of making sure that we could see traffic to the Strait of Hormuz. And we are seeing traffic to the Strait of Hormuz. So President Trump, again and again, being very clear on this issue, fundamentally, the Iranian regime cannot be allowed to have a nuclear weapon and will not have a nuclear weapon because of the actions that President Trump took. There's no guessing what the president wants because he's so clear about it. You don't need to guess. He tells you directly. He says it again and again. And that's exactly what we're seeing the president do here, taking action to make the United States safer.
On the economic element of this, the Operation Economic Outcast, as the Treasury Secretary has called it, what's the plan to get Russia and China on board to isolate Iran more economically?
Well, look, as the Treasury Secretary said when he announced Operation Economic Outcast, the Treasury Department has mapped out all of the financial facilitators that the Iranian regime has left. Of course, we have seen from the Trump administration a maximum pressure policy that goes back to the beginning of this administration and the previous Trump administration, where we have identified entities that have been facilitating the financing of Iran's malign activities, including the funding of their terrorist proxies, the nuclear weapons program, their ballistic missile program, for example. So the Treasury Department has identified elements that are continuing to finance or allow for the financing of the Iranian regime. And the message has been very clear from this administration that we are going to sever the remaining lifelines, the remaining economic lifelines the Iranian regime has. We're going to sever the regime from them. And so we're seeing a continuation of this maximum pressure policy taken to the next level, making clear that we're going to take the action here to deny the Iranian regime the finances they need to continue this malign activity.
But doesn't taking it to the next level really require getting China and Russia on board?
Well, look, we're continuing to have conversations with countries across the world on this, but the message has been clearly sent. There is no mistaking the message, as the president himself has said, that we have identified the remaining financial lifelines that the Iranian regime has. And as the Treasury Secretary said, we are going to take action to sever the Iranian regime from those lifelines.
I want to ask you about the deal with Venezuela now. The very complex agreement requiring all sorts of entities within the federal government to get involved here. A few different things on this. Will the text of the agreement ever be released publicly?
Well, we'll continue to describe what is entailed in the deal. As you, as your viewers likely know, there's many different elements here in terms of different deals that are part of this. In terms of, we see the interim authorities offering these 100-year concessions to North American Blue Energy Partners. Then we see the United States engaging in this deal with this private company in terms of the equity stake and the right to purchase 20% of the production at an offtake low cost amount. So we are seeing many different elements to describe the nature of this deal. And what I can say and what I can make sure that your viewers are rest assured about is that this will be governed by the highest U.S. governance, including jurisdiction in U.S. courts. We'll see Americans on the board of this, and we'll be making sure that we're seeing a system here under which the American people benefit, but so do the Venezuelan people, where we'll actually have a system in place where the Venezuelan people are able to benefit from this vast wealth that they have, as opposed to what we saw under the illegitimate Maduro regime, where the benefit went to Maduro and his cronies.
You mentioned that private company that the Pentagon is basically seeding to help get the oil out. It's run by a guy, or in part by a guy named Alejandro Betancourt, who's got a bit of a checkered past. Is he to be trusted by the United States? Is he a trusted partner?
Well, what we see here is a proven operator that is currently even operating within Venezuela, which means that we're going to be able to scale this production. We see this plan to scale this production to a massive amount.
So we can trust
them? Which will benefit the American people. Well, that's why I mentioned the U.S. governance. That's why I mentioned the jurisdiction in U.S. courts. That's why I mentioned the highest levels of auditing to make sure that we're seeing this deal implemented in the way that it should be. That's part of this deal. That's part of the provisions that we're seeing here. So what we can trust is that we're seeing a deal here that is going to benefit the American people for decades to come. And again, to stress,
how soon?
Not just the American people, the Venezuelan people. Well, that's part of the reason why the proving operator is so important. What we have here is a proven operator that's been able to operate in Venezuela. So we will see over several months here, I'm not going to put too fine of a timeline on it as this continues to develop. But over several months here, we'll see the beginning of this deal in terms of the offtake that's possible. But then we'll see that scaling that's possible. That scaling that's possible as part of this deal for what is the largest oil deal in the history of the world. So this is a deal that will have short-term benefits, of course, but also long-term benefits for our children and children's children.
I want to ask you about two other quick subjects in other parts of the world, although this one's nearby. There are local reports that Raul Castro in Cuba is ill. And possibly has suffered a stroke. Does the State Department know anything about that?
At this point, I have nothing to offer on this, but I will reiterate from a general standpoint when it comes to Cuba that we remain dedicated in seeing a Cuba where the Cuban people can be happy and prosperous as they are in so many other areas. And we have yet to see the regime in Cuba take the steps necessary to allow that to be possible.
In Nepal, at least 75 Americans are still missing. What's the latest on rescue operations, either led by the United States, or what is the State Department's latest on figuring out where those Americans are?
Well, as of 4:30 p.m. this evening, I can say 75 Americans currently are unaccounted for. We have seen 14 Americans that have been safely evacuated from Nepal. We continue to be in close coordination with both the governments of China and Nepal. Our embassies in Beijing and Kathmandu are working 24/7 on this. If you are in the region or want to contact the State Department, please go to travel.state.gov. You'll see the numbers there based off of where you are in the world to contact the State Department. At the State Department, we have activated $3.6 million in emergency humanitarian assistance. That includes food, that includes sanitation, that includes water. It also includes the rehabilitation of roadways, as well as the mobilization of specialized transport options to reach hard-to-reach areas. This is a remote area that's hard to reach in the best of times, made more so by this devastation. So we remain in close contact with local authorities. We've mobilized this humanitarian assistance, and our highest commitment remains to the safety and security of the American people, working 24/7 to get reliable information out of the region and to assist those Americans who need assistance.
Tommy, you're pretty effective at this from a State Department perspective, at least in giving us responses here. Would you be interested in a promotion if one opened up at the White House, say at the briefing room podium?
They have many, many talented people at the White House and otherwise that the president has no shortage of people to choose from. I have some people that I may be rooting for in the back of my head, but obviously the president's going to make the best decision he sees fit.
We hear there's a briefing coming on Thursday, so we're trying to figure out who it is that's actually going to be leading that briefing. But they have your resume, I suppose, right? Just in case.
Well, we work very closely with the White House. They have so many talented people over there.
He's a diplomat.
Really working every day.
You work for diplomats. You're being diplomatic. Tommy Pigott, don't be a stranger. Come back anytime. Thank you for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you.
Still to come on The Takeout, the Army Secretary Dan Driscoll's decision to step down after months of tension with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, what we know about the latest military leader to resign. Also, my conversation with Texas Democratic Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett. You know her. We discuss attempts to reduce the number of polling places in her home state and why she isn't campaigning for James Tallarico. Plus, a local guy, New York City congressional candidate Brad Lander, he's here after being verbally accosted by anti-Israel hecklers despite his close ties to Mayor Zohran Mamdani. He'll join us to discuss all that. Stay with us. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds.
Matching outfits, extravagant birthdays, many nicknames, a few classic moves of a dog-obsessed parent. At Ollie, they're obsessed with how obsessed you are with your pup, which is why they obsess over giving your dog the best. Ollie's fresh, human-grade recipes are developed by real chefs and backed by vet nutritionists. The meals are perfectly portioned and come with a puptainer and scoop for easy storing and mess-free serving, delivering the best experience for you and your pup. And through the Ollie app, you can actually check in on your dog's health with real vets. By uploading a picture, their team can check your dog's weight, digestion, teeth, and coat, They'll then provide next steps on how to keep them thriving. And because they're just as obsessed as you are, there is zero judgment if you check in every day. You could say Ollie feeds the obsession. Go to ollie.com/firstbox and use code FIRSTBOX to get 70% off your welcome kit. Ollie, feed the obsession.
Now that the school year is officially underway, families are getting a clearer picture of where students are thriving and where they might need a little extra support. It's the perfect time to reinforce what they're learning in class and build confidence along the way. That's where IXL comes in. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand their schoolwork. Whether they're building math confidence, strengthening reading and writing skills, or reviewing science concepts, from pre-K through 12th grade, IXL offers personalized, interactive learning that adapts to each child's unique level and pace. IXL supports classroom learning by providing personalized practice that aligns with what students are already studying. It's proven to improve achievement, with results seen in all 50 states. Plus, one subscription covers everything for all the kids in your home, making it a time-saving and cost-effective choice. It's a resource trusted nationwide, and IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. Listeners of this podcast can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXLLearning.com/audio. Visit IXLLearning.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Welcome back to The Takeout. The White House has confirmed that Army Secretary Dan Driscoll is resigning. There have been months of friction between him and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. CBS News reported last week Driscoll was considering stepping down by the end of the year, but obviously he is resigning now. In a statement to CBS News, a White House spokesperson said Secretary Driscoll has been highly effective in advancing President Trump's agenda. The United States Army is more powerful than ever thanks to his work alongside the Commander-in-Chief and what the White House calls the Secretary of War. Former CIA officer and Marine Corps veteran Elliot Ackerman joins us now. He's also a CBS News contributor and the author of a really great series of books. Elliot, I'm ashamed I didn't mention this to you last time I saw you in person. 2034, 2054, 2084, I'm working on right now. I'm almost done with it. Thank you. About the future of war. Elliot, thank you for being here. Why is Driscoll resigning after 18 months as Army Secretary, and what does it signal about what's going on inside the Pentagon right now?
Thanks so much. I mean, it seems as though, you know, Driscoll is resigning, you know, based off of internal conflicts that he has with Secretary Hegseth, particularly with regards to personnel matters, you know, promotions at the one-star level that Secretary Hegseth has been blocking, as well as differences of opinion that he and Driscoll have had on major personnel issues, such as the Chief of Staff of the Army, who resigned earlier this year.
He'd been trying to modernize the Army by investing in programs like drone warfare while also cutting other costs, which is often a Republican priority when it comes to the overall scope of the defense budget. What were the biggest disagreements between him and Hegseth, best we can tell?
Well, you know, it seems that most of these disagreements seem to be kind of about, you know, cultural issues, which is ironic in so much as Secretary Hegseth really positioned himself as being a secretary who would get the Department of Defense singularly focused on war fighting. And, you know, Driscoll seemed to be doing that, you know, conducting a massive program of modernization, as you mentioned, focused on drone warfare, hypersonic missiles, really modernizing the force. And the disagreement seems to be on Secretary Hegseth's fixation on cultural issues like abolishing DEI and differences of opinion about promotions with regards to, you know, women and officers who are of minority background.
There have been a number of Army generals who've also resigned in recent months, and our Ellie Watson reports this afternoon, at least 10 now have been removed from Army promotion lists by the Defense Secretary. How does that impact not only the war with Iran, but perhaps military operations overall, if you're now seeing a bunch of these guys hit a ceiling and get out perhaps sooner than anticipated?
Well, it's not good. I mean, it doesn't send a signal of confidence that, you know, senior military leaders feel as though they should stay in uniform or really have a path forward under the current leadership in the Department of Defense. So obviously that's coming at a very important time in our nation's defense, a time when we are trying to modernize and at a time where we are in the midst of an act of war. And so I think for the troops, for the war fighters, as Secretary Hegseth is frequently referring to, you know, what you want is strong and stable leadership, and the force doesn't really have that right now.
In our remaining minute, Driscoll's pretty tight with Vice President Vance. They went to Yale Law School together. Losing him in the Defense Department leadership, what does that do to the vice president's sway over war planning, over the military generally in this administration?
Well, listen, I think decision-making in this administration, I mean, really is driven from the very top, and that is President Trump. And obviously, you know, the vice president has a line directly into the president. But I think where it really hurts the Trump administration, it's going to be after the midterms, it's going to be very difficult to get somebody confirmed in that role, given how tight it was, even when the Republicans had control of the Senate. So, you know, if there is a switch in power in Congress, it's going to make it very difficult for the Trump administration to get somebody in and confirmed to replace Driscoll.
All right, Elliot Ackerman, thank you as always for joining us. Good to see you. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, New York Democratic congressional candidate Brad Lander, his confrontation with anti-Israel hecklers, what he thinks of that, and what House Democrats should do next year if they take power. Stay with us. You're watching The Takeout. Back to The Takeout. Demonstrators confronted New York Democratic congressional candidate Brad Lander this past weekend over his stance on Israel. He was protesting a Hindu nationalist's appearance at Madison Square Garden. While there, some demonstrators got in Lander's face and heckled him. They said things like, get the F out, and that no Zionists are welcome. Lander, who is Jewish, considers himself a liberal Zionist and has also called Israel's campaign in Gaza a genocide. Given that we are here in the Big Apple, we called upon Mr. Lander to be here with us. Controller, he is the city controller. Thank you for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Absolutely. Well, you know, you faced this type of criticism before.
And I'll face it again.
Yeah, you probably will. But how much harm do these types of confrontations do to those who are trying to make the point that, in their view, the Palestinian people have been, you know, severely affected and hurt, damaged by what's been going on?
Yeah, well, let's start here. This was a protest against Hindu nationalism. Mohan right. Bhagwat, the head of the RSS, this Hindu fascist organization that's, you know, promotes hate and discrimination against Muslims and Sikhs and Dalits in India. That was what I was there for. I've been invited by the organizers to be there. And, you know, I'm trying to talk about that so I don't distract from the cause I was invited to support. But yes, I mean, I hate what Israel is doing in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon. I think it meets the definition of genocide in Gaza. I want not to be sending U.S. military aid to Israel, but I still believe in the vision and the possibility of a Jewish and democratic Israel. I think it's very short-sighted for a couple of knuckleheads to say, if you believe that, you're not welcome even to stand up against hate and fascism.
You are not the only Democratic congressional candidate to face this kind of confrontation. Scott Wiener out in California had a similar run-in over the summer. He's also Jewish and has voiced his support for Palestinians. Do these kind of incidents, in your view, are they anti-Semitic?
Well, I didn't get much chance to talk to the people who were banging the drum and screaming in my face. They're jerks. They're assholes. I have no idea what their position on Jews are. What they said was, we don't want no Zionists here. Now, sometimes that's code for Jews, and sometimes people would say, you know, there are plenty of anti-Zionist Jews. From my point of view, I think it's a dead-end politics. And I was pleased that lots of Palestinians online actually stood up and said, look, we don't agree with Lander on everything. The folks who might support a binational state rather than a Jewish and a Palestinian state. But we know he wants to end U.S. military aid. He's going to fight for Palestinian human rights and freedom. We ought to build bigger coalitions. And that is what I want to say to people. Don't be deterred by building interfaith coalitions for justice, because out of dozens or hundreds of people, there's a couple of numbskulls.
You're one of those who is all but assured to head to Congress. Very blue district. You know, we have blue and red districts across the country, hundreds of them, that basically once the primary is determined, the winner is determined. And you're one of them. Yeah. Park Slope, Park Brooklyn, very Democratic area. So let's talk a little bit about what Congress might look like going into next year.
Yeah.
Hakeem Jeffries, the House Minority Leader, another New York City guy, was asked earlier today what he thinks the priority should be should the Democrats take back the House. Let's take a listen to what he said.
We have to reverse the Medicaid cuts. We should extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits. We should restore congressional authority as it relates to tariffs, because the Trump tariffs are making life more expensive for the American people.
I saw you shaking your head through some of that there. Health care costs, obviously, tariffs, which helps to deal with the cost of things. You're shaking your head in agreement. Is there anything else he's missing?
Well, if we're talking about congressional authority, I do think congressional authority over war and foreign policy we should reassert as well. If we don't want to be in endless wars, we should read the Constitution, which says only Congress can declare it. But I do agree that health care costs, you know, probably the best thing Democrats did last year was say the shutdown is about not doubling people's costs on the exchanges or cutting the Medicare and Medicaid that rural hospitals need. And we should not pass a budget that doesn't restore those health care subsidies.
You know Hakeem Jeffries through New York politics.
We go back a long way.
You know there's a handful of progressives like yourself who are withholding judgment on him, withholding potential support. What would you say to those skeptics?
Yeah, I mean, I've been clear that I plan to vote for Hakeem because we want a unified party behind a speaker that can fight on affordability. But I understand that people, you know, want the energy that's come in these primaries. People, you know, more than 100 Democrats said we don't want to send any additional U.S. military aid to Israel. Lots of Democratic voters just want tougher fighting. I mean, what is Trump doing in Canada, or what is ICE doing in the streets of our neighborhood and in our courts? We need to show fiercer fight, real accountability, real delivery for working people. And that's the energy voters want. That's what elected some of these folks. And I do think it's important for leadership to say, we hear that, we're going to fight harder, we're going to deliver for working people.
In our remaining 30 seconds or so, if a voter says impeach the president, should you guys get back the Democratic majority? What do you say?
First, let's focus on real accountability. I want the people who killed Renee Good and Alex Preddy to go to jail for it. I want the healthcare executives and the AI executives who are picking our pockets to be held accountable. So real strong accountability from the next Congress in a way that people understand, how does that deliver for me, make my life easier, deliver on my cost of living?
All right. Former New York City Comptroller and current candidate for Congress, Brad Lander, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you.
For coming over to this borough for the afternoon. We appreciate it.
It's great to be here.
All righty. Next up, it is primary day in Massachusetts. Our reporter panel will weigh in on the Seth Moulton, Ed Markey Democratic Senate contest. Stay with us. You're watching The Takeout.
With summer coming to an end, you're going to be spending more time indoors. Get your home ready and save up to 50% off custom window treatments during the Labor Day Mega Sale at Blinds.com. From room darkening to light filtering shades, finding the perfect fit is easy. Get free samples, expert design help, and professional measure and install services. Or DIY with confidence and support every step of the way. Shop up to 50% off site-wide plus huge savings on doorbusters right now during the Labor Day Mega Sale at Blinds.com.
Hey there, I'm Kendra Adachi, and my show, The Lazy Genius Podcast, helps you be a genius about the things that matter and lazy about the things that don't, and you get to decide what matters. I'm not here to tell you what to do. I'm here to give you a new way to see. Episodes of The Lazy Genius Podcast are full of compassionate time management tips and permission slips to do what makes sense for you. New episodes drop every Monday. Follow and listen to The Lazy Genius Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you finally have a free day out on the town. You're about to enjoy a nice lunch when you get the alert that a window's been broken at home and you're miles away. These are the wake-up calls that remind us, in 1 second, everything can change. ADT security systems are built for those moments. They help keep your home safer with 24/7 monitoring. No one wants to feel unsafe at home or vulnerable when you're away. And with ADT, you won't. Their systems are professionally installed by trained technicians, so you can trust them to watch out for your home from day one. ADT has the most company-operated monitoring centers in the industry, and the ADT Plus app lets you keep tabs on your home from anywhere you have service. You'll get the alerts that matter about your home safety. Don't wait to prepare your home for an emergency. When every second counts, count on ADT. Visit ADT.com. That's ADT.com. Or call 1-800-ADT-ASAP. That's 1-800-ADT-ASAP.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Here's a look at what else we're watching this evening. The House is set to vote on whether to censure North Carolina Republican Congressman Chuck Edwards after debating the matter today. Last month's House Ethics Committee investigation found Edwards, quote, engaged in persistent, unprofessional, and inappropriate conduct towards two of his female staffers. It did not find any evidence he engaged in sexual activity with those staffers. Edwards ultimately ended his reelection campaign in the wake of the report. What could happen in moments? If it does, we'll bring you the results if they occur here during the takeout. There's a familiar-looking building in Washington, and it's set to become the home of a new museum. The Smithsonian Institution has chosen this building as the future home of the National Museum of the American Latino. It'll be located in the historic Arts and Industries Building, which you see there, sits on the Mall. By putting the museum inside an existing Smithsonian building, the governing board is able to bypass congressional approval because Congress authorized the museum in 2020, and since 2022, a temporary exhibition has been located in the National Museum of American History. They have been fighting, however, over where exactly to put it, a few other museums, and the valuable real estate left there on the National Mall. As we mentioned, voters in Massachusetts are at the polls today for the Bay State's primary elections. A notable contest is between Congressman Seth Moulton, who is challenging 80-year-old Senator Ed Markey. Moulton, who is 47, has said he and Markey agree on many issues, but that it's time for generational change in the Democratic Party. Let's bring in our reporters to discuss this. Nikki Ramirez covers politics for Rolling Stone, and Alec Hernandez is a national politics reporter for Politico. Great to see both of you here. Nikki, let's start with you. This one has been a generational clash, and really, it's Moulton's whole argument was, I'm younger than the other guy.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem to be working.
No, it's not good enough. I think that's the baseline here. Of course, coming out of 2024, there has been concerns, not just on the Democratic side, but also to an extent in Republican politics about the gentocracy, about age becoming a liability for lawmakers, lawmakers being out of touch with their constituency. And we've seen it throughout these primaries. I think Ed Markey is so far the exception to the rule. And when something like that happens, it's good to look at this race and see, well, what does that tell us about the rule itself? And I think what we're getting here is that it's not enough to just say, I'm younger than him. Markey has a track record that has been consistent, that his voters know and are familiar with, and speaks to the issues that are motivating this election cycle, particularly issues of affordability, healthcare coverage, and a reluctance to participate in stupid wars. So Seth Moulton, he's making the argument that he's young, he's new, he's fresh, but for voters, that's not enough to actually deal with the core issues motivating their vote this cycle, which is fundamentally the economy.
Right. And when you run ads with Elizabeth Warren,
yeah,
Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Bay State star Ayanna Pressley, it's kind of hard to argue with that,
yeah,
when it's progressives who are showing up in the primary. Alec, anything else worth pointing,
yeah,
out?
Yeah, I think, you know, to go off that point, too, I think what's so interesting about this race is it kind of flips on its head, you know, what we see in a lot of these races, particularly in Democratic primaries, where there are a lot of younger, more progressive candidates who are trying to take out older sort of candidates who have been around for much longer, someone like an Ed Markey. But this race flips that dynamic on its head, and that Markey is the more progressive of the,
yeah,
two. And so he's, you know, in some ways, because Massachusetts isn't going to be this sort of big general election battleground, to me, what's interesting is that it's sort of telling on potentially where the direction of the Democratic Party is going, right? Is the appetite for more progressive policies, or is it for younger candidates, or is it both?
Yeah.
And tonight we'll get a little bit of a look.
Certainly
at
in a
both
blue state, it would be a progressive candidate, it seems, is what they really are more concerned about. Although I've heard from some Massachusetts voters say, the guy's been in office in one way or another for 54 years.
Yeah.
There are very few people left at the national level who can say that. Alec, we've noted this week the president's been pretty vocal in his support of all things, data centers, mm-hmm, at a time when both parties are trying to distance themselves from any previous support for them. He recently posted on, of all places, Truth Social, the only reason communities throughout the U.S. say should not want data centers is if they want to end up being backwards and poor. You have covered the rage against data centers. How is this going to land?
I mean, I would say if I am a vulnerable Republican House member or a Republican running for Senate, this is not really the closing message that I want to enter the sort of Labor Day stretch with. I think what's interesting about this issue in particular is that Trump is sort of the outlier in his party and really sort of across the political spectrum on this issue, being so forthright in support of data centers. I remember, you know, earlier this spring, even just 4 or 5 months ago, I was down in Georgia writing about this exact thing, about data centers and how that was starting to bubble up in primaries in Georgia. And, you know, Republicans and Democrats in Georgia at the time told me, hey, you know, this is sort of bubbling up in our races here. And maybe a cycle or two from now, this will be a big federal issue. And 4 months down the road, it has exploded, you know, sort of across the board, across party lines into sort of this unifying, in some ways, issue that Democrats and Republicans both agree on. So for Trump to really be going out on such a limb, you know, for data centers in this sense, it's not a great issue, particularly for these vulnerable Republicans.
Do we think any Republican is going to follow his lead on this? I mean, we've seen even Greg Abbott reverse his position
on this. No, I don't think so. I think what we're seeing here is Trump making the same mistake that a lot of the tech companies that are undergirding the AI revolution make, which is thinking that voters and Americans are ignorant about how data centers operate, why they're necessary, and how they work. I think it's not necessarily that this is just cut and dry a backlash to the construction of data centers. It's part of a larger backlash to this idea that voters are seeing their local, state, and federal governments prioritize corporations over their own needs. Mm-hmm. You're asking for improved education, improved infrastructure in your town, and all of a sudden this company moves in, gets a bunch of tax breaks to build this data center without contributing to the necessities of your own community, without input from you as someone who lives there and is making a life there. And I think it's part of this larger feeling of alienation that voters have to the politics they say they're participating in.
In our remaining 45 seconds or so, you guys call around, you talk to Republicans across the country. Do you know of any that are actually planning to go to the RNC midterm convention next week?
We shall see. We know that Trump is saying basically it's going to be Trumpapalooza. I think there was a Republican Party chairman who said that. So we'll wait and see who turns up and what sort of the spectacle becomes.
I think the list of those who are staying as far away from Dallas as possible is growing. And it's, you know, none of those in competitive races are necessarily going to be there. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know I have to be there.
I will also be there.
Will you?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll find you. We'll have to see exactly who shows up. Alec, Nikki, thank you both for being here. We appreciate it. Coming up next, Texas Democratic Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett, how she plans to help her party in the final stretch of the midterms, some concerns she has about potential voting rights issues in the Lone Star State of Texas. Stay with us. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Local officials in Texas are voting on whether to cut the number of polling sites in the Lone Star State's third largest county. If approved, the plan would slash the number of polling sites by 92 in Tarrant County from what they had for the 2022 midterms. Officials say it would get rid of low turnout sites, while Democrats argue it's voter suppression. Tarrant County encompasses Fort Worth and Arlington, Texas. And earlier, I spoke with Texas Democratic Congressman Jasmine Crockett, who represents some of Tarrant County. Here's our conversation. Congresswoman Crockett, thank you so much for joining us. I'm curious, are you opposed overall to the idea of closing or reforming the way that polling sites are set up in the county? Or is it just perhaps too close to the midterms to make these kinds of changes right now?
I think I take issue with both. I'm absolutely opposed to the idea of reducing the number of polling locations, which will lead to confusion in a very short amount of time. We know that the Republicans pulled some games during our primary that caused for confusion and overall ultimately resulted in the disenfranchisement of voters in Dallas County. So the reason for playing these games, they still haven't laid it out. And so the only thing that I can tell you is that they were upset at the amount of participation that came in during those primaries where Democrats voted overwhelmingly at a higher rate than Republicans, and therefore they want to cause confusion and engage in voter suppression.
Officials have said that this only affects lower turnout sites and that they've had difficulty recruiting poll workers, which is not unique to Texas, or certainly not unique to the DFW. Is there something you could be doing, others in the community could be doing to try to recruit or encourage people to be poll workers on Election Day?
Yeah, so the Tarrant County Democratic Party is consistently asking people to participate, trying to make sure that they get trained up. But let me be clear about this. When I was in the State House, and they've continued to engage in this type of action in the State House, What they do is they create new laws that make people say, you know what, I don't know if it's worth it to actually go and volunteer. And I say volunteer because this isn't a job that's going to pay you a ton of money. Right. And a lot of people do this because they really just want to participate in democracy.
You know that the president signed an executive order back in March that sets up a system with the Homeland Security Department and the Postal Service to work together to try to establish essentially a federal nationwide list of voters who also are U.S. citizens. I imagine in your consistent work on voting rights that this is concerning to you. Have you gotten any sense from constituents whether they're aware that this is even in the works or what it could potentially do to confuse voters this fall?
I think that there's been a lot that's been in the news about the fact that they are trying to change the rules for those states that don't turn over lists, or that the federal government and DHS are trying to come together with a list instead of the Secretary of State. The reality is that Texas is run by Republicans, and so therefore they really shouldn't have an issue with Texas. But we also know that they did send their voter rolls up to D.C. What I will tell you is that right now this is a game of keeping people from voting instead of bringing about policies that will make people say, hey, we want to vote for Republicans. That's all it is.
Do you believe the polls that suggest James Tallarico and Jeanine Hinojosa have an edge over Ken Paxton and Greg Abbott?
I think that polls are just that. They're polls. We've been disappointed by polls before. And so what I will tell anyone who is planning to vote, especially if you're a Texan, just get out and vote, because the only poll that matters is the poll that you hit on Election Day.
You have said in recent days that you don't have plans to campaign with the U.S. Senate candidate, the Democratic Senate candidate, James Tallarico, and instead are going to be running or campaigning for other Democrats down the ballot in Texas. Part of the argument that Texas Democrats have made for years, that long term you're not going to succeed in that state unless you're getting people elected to the school board, the city council, the county judge level, the state legislature. Are there examples of the kinds of candidates or the people you're specifically planning to campaign for that sort of illuminate that argument, that concern, that focus you're going to have?
I am so excited that you brought this up, because one of those candidates is actually Commissioner Lisa Simmons in Tarrant County, who is running to become the county judge. And now people are understanding why it is so important to have someone that cares about democracy at that post. Tarrant County is the third largest county that we have in the state of Texas. And we want somebody that is going to look at its great diversity and not say, you know what, let's play games as it relates to the diversity in this county, but instead wants to engage all of the citizens of Tarrant County. So she is one of those candidates. We have another one in the largest county in Texas, Letitia Plummer, who is running for county judge down there as well as Dexter McCoy. So you just got out of me what we have not publicly released, which is that I am going to be supporting those three county judge candidates, as well as some of these state house candidates. You know that myself, as well as James Tallarico, we came from the state house. Yep. In fact, James Tallarico was swept into the state house because of Beto. So we need to make sure that we've got the right people in place for when they try to come up with gerrymandering or jerry-rigging these seats again in a couple of years.
We should point out to the uninitiated who are not from the Lone Star State or haven't spent time there, county judge in other states is the county executive, in essence, the person who runs the county. It's not someone who sits with a robe listening to court cases, but someone who actually, so they're quite powerful, because they oversee pretty big budgets and the policing and other big issues of concern. And that is why there's a real belief that you guys have to focus on that. You say you don't plan a campaign with James Tallarico. When was the last time you talked to him about strategy or about some sense of how it is the party should be working together ahead of November?
I have not talked to him in recent times about strategy. As the Democratic nominee, I trust that he has a plan, and he and his team, they're running that plan. I know that their plan wasn't necessarily to include his opponent. I mean, that's kind of weird. We don't normally do that. But one of the things about me is that I really do care. I've never run for office simply because I was looking for a title for myself. I've always run for office because I wanted to make sure that this country was going to be better for me and my neighbors. And so that's why I am going to make sure that I do everything that I can to help as many people as I can. And ultimately, that will help James Tallarico and the other statewide candidates that are running.
You are a congresswoman for about four more months. They won't be in session that entire time. But if there was one thing you could get done before you leave office, what would it be?
It would be the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Absolutely. If I had my wish list, that is exactly what we would pass. It would save our democracy in so many ways.
On theme, you are Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett from the DFW area, someone who has focused on voting rights in her state and across the country throughout her tenure. We appreciate you being here. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks, Ed.
And that does it for today, this Tuesday edition of The Takeout. I'm Ed O'Keefe at the CBS Broadcast Center in New York. How fancy of us.
Hey, gang, it's Jill Schlesinger. I'm launching a new show. It's called Money Moves, and we are going to move. We are going to answer your financial questions and take the mystery out of your financial life. Follow and listen wherever you get your podcasts.